yes, yes.
Okay, so we are in our fifth installment.
Bless you.
Bless you.
Can you sum up the first four?
I'll give you a little catch up for sure. We're going through a journey of Jewish history. We're looking at different periods of Jewish history from the last 1,000 years, and with a specific focus on how the rabbinic community dealt with different challenges that came up at different time periods. The last few weeks, we've been looking at the 18th and 19th centuries, and how with new freedoms that were granted to the Jewish community in Europe, in particular, the different communities were faced with new opportunities, and at the same time, these new opportunities brought on a number of different types of challenges. In our last discussion, we looked at innovation from the technological point of view, progress, innovation, science, and how that brought with it numerous issues that the Jewish community had to deal with. One of the focuses that we looked at was the invention of the machines that were being used for creation of matzah, baking of matzot, whether there was problems behind that, and a few other topics related to that as well. This week we're going to look at a different type of innovation from the 19th century. So we titled this class 19th Century Judaism. And we're going to look at the major movements of the 19th century, which were all in a way innovative. Each in their own way innovated within how do we hold on? How do we respond to the pressing issues of the time? As we know, the emancipation, which we spoke about at length a number of weeks back, gave the Jews a lot of new possibilities for professional life, for education, for social interaction, for living situation, many, many different levels. Certain types of professions that they couldn't be involved in before, as we mentioned. And with this came about a lot of new types of contact between Jews and non-Jews. As we titled it then, I think the opening of the ghetto. And that opening of the ghetto created certain issues, certain challenges. One of the figures that we spoke about at length was Moses Mendelssohn and his student, Naftali Hertz Wessely, who in their formulation, they didn't think that they were really compromising on their Jewish traditions by engaging in the new politics, the new philosophies, the values of the time. But it wasn't too long after, 30, 40 years, we're jumping now to the year 1818. 1818 was an explosion in the Jewish community. In a town called Hamburg, Germany, the new organization called the New Israelite Temple Association built the first temple, the first reform temple in history, in Jewish history. And this was a major moment, a major shift from traditional Judaism, major shift from many of the classic traditions that we are familiar with. And a lot of things changed from this point. So what we're going to look at is where reform came from, what were they thinking, what was behind their innovation, and how the rest of the Jewish community reacted. So we're going to look at the three main reactions to the reform stream of Judaism from that time. And we're going to look at the ultra-Orthodox response, the Neo-Orthodox, or what some today might call the modern Orthodox response, and the conservative response. We're going to look at each of them and try to see how these different communities, different rabbinic leaders, were reacting at that time. But just as an opening comment and question for all of us to think about, and I really do think it's hard today to think about our own adherence, our own connection, our own level of observance, whatever community we're from, whatever shul or synagogue we affiliate with, or community we affiliate with, we have to remember that 200 years ago, the threat to the Jewish people was for everyone. It wasn't something that was only impacting one group. It was impacting the entirety. And all the different types of leaders, all the different individuals in the communities were basically dealing with the question of, what do we do? How do we respond to this? How do we deal with this issue? So, let's jump in. We want to look at the first source here. First source was it's taken from a book that was called Or Noga, written by a man named Eliezer Lieberman. We don't really know a lot about him. We do know that his father was a famous rabbi, but we don't really know that much about him himself. What we do know is that he was a very smart person. He was a very learned person. And the Reform, this new group, this new Israelite Temple Association, basically hired him to give halachic Torah base for some of the innovations that were being promoted in this new temple. So instead of just building the temple and bringing in an organ and changing the sermon to German and taking out some of the prayers and printing not a Sidur, but a Shabbat and Yom Tov Sidur, a Sidur that was specifically for not three times a day prayer, but only Shabbat prayer, and a number of other changes, which I'll mention along the way, to give it legitimacy, to give it a sense of basis, it needed to be rooted in Torah sources. It needed to have a weight to it. So this guy, Eliezer Lieberman, was hired or solicited, and he was brought in, and he wrote two books. He wrote one book called Noga Tzedek, and then he wrote an appendix called Or Noga. So that's what you see here in source number one. These are just some excerpts from that book, translated obviously from the original German, and what Hebrew, German, that you probably interspersed in there. And what he does is he gives a defense for some of the new ideas that were being brought in to their community and their new temple. So what you have to keep in mind as we look at this is these people saw these new opportunities to join society. And what they wanted to do, and this is really where some of the challenges came up, is to blur the lines. They felt that if we're here in this society, if we want to be accepted, if we want to have full recognition by our neighbors, we need to create the appearance. And a lot of this actually was about the aesthetics. It was also about the principles as well, meaning what they actually believed. But a lot of it was the external. What does our synagogue look like? What are the things that we incorporate into our synagogue so that they will look more like churches, for example? And here are some of the arguments that he made. So source number one, you have here on the left side. Why should we not draw a lesson from the peoples among whom we live? Look at the Gentiles and see how they stand in awe and reverence. This is about the aesthetic point that I mentioned before. And with good manners in their house of prayer. Quiet.
I thought Jacobs did that anyway.
You thought? Yeah.
That was well.
Very good. No one utters a word. No one utters a word. No one moves a limb. Their ears and all their senses are directed to the words of the preacher and to the recitation of their prayers. Now judge, please, you blessed of God, people of the Lord, seedlings of the faithful, how very much more there is for us to do. Are we not obligated to be most discreet and to guard our steps and the utterances of our lips when we go to the house of God? Will someone say that it is prohibited to learn from our neighbors, that you should not abide by their statutes? There are certain things that we're not supposed to learn, and we're not supposed to incorporate into our tradition from, I don't have any more, so we'll just share with your neighbor. There are certain things that we're not supposed to take on from the practices of non-Jewish groups or nations, especially idolatrous practices that we're not supposed to incorporate. His point is, if there's something that's respectful that we can learn from another way of worship, and their way of worship brings a certain type of sanctity or respect or seriousness to a house of worship, then that's something that we should consider. And then what he goes on to do, and if anyone wants to see the whole piece, I'm happy to send it to anyone who'd like. Just let me know after. He'll give me your email and I'll send it to you. He goes on to quote all these different rabbinic sources, from early sources, from medieval sources. And here's one example in the right column. If you look in the right column, he's quoting here from the Rambam, Maimonides, in the laws of Kiddush HaChodesh, the laws of Rosh Chodesh, laws of sanctifying the new moon, the new month. And what he does there is he says, even the Rambam himself, even Maimonides himself, admitted that there were certain types of information, sciences, that would inform Jewish practice that he wasn't able himself to know from Jewish sources. And he would have to turn to the books of the Greeks or the books of other thinkers to be able to, Greek sages, as he mentions it there. You can read through that part yourself. But his point is that we have many sources, and this is why they took an individual, the Reformed community took an individual who knew the Jewish sources, so he could quote all these different rabbinic sources and medieval sources and say, hey, look, the Rambam said that we can learn from the Greeks, and this scholar said that we can use the information that was created from a different religion or a different people, if that's something that will benefit us. And then he writes, if you look in the bottom left corner there, to be sure, my brethren and compatriots, tears well up in the eyes of every man of feeling. And this is now relating to the early decision, one of the early decisions in the Sidurim that were printed. A lot has changed in 200 years of the liturgy and the Reform service. But in the early liturgy, they actually removed references to Israel. They removed references to Tzion. They removed references to the Mashiach. They removed references to the Geula, to the redemption. All of these things were taken out, all for the purpose of serving the need of, we're here in Germany now. We're here. It's 1818. This is where we are. This is where our community is. There wasn't really talk about Zionism just yet. We're going to get to that in coming weeks. There wasn't really this talk about a return. Obviously, that was something that Jews have been talking about forever, but it wasn't anything on a serious level at that point. So taking that out of the liturgy, in a way, made them feel like we're here in Germany, and this is our Jerusalem. And that was something that was said by many Jews in many of the countries and cities that they lived in. And he writes, to be sure, my brethren and compatriots, tears well up in the eyes of every man of feeling when he remembers that our holy city is burnt and its gates desolate, and we must say along with the exiles, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem. Nevertheless, the prayer for the land of our birth, our present dwelling place, must take precedence in time, and we should always pray for its safety and for the well-being of its people. So it's interesting to hear how the arguments are being shaped around creating policies that are really changing traditions that were traditions for 2,000 years or 1,800 years at that point. And then he writes near the conclusion of his essay, when the ministers and sages in the right bottom right column there, when the ministers and sages of the Gentiles come to our places of worship to observe our customs and to hear the words of our teachers, who instruct the people regarding the past. So when all the non-Jews come into our synagogues and look at how we are practicing our religion, right? They hear merely the sound of noise in the camp of the Hebrews and do not understand anything. What are they hearing? They're hearing us mumbling prayer. This is clearly coming from a very negative view, whether it was his own negative view or that he was reflecting a view that was being espoused and expressed by those in this community, that the way that Jews pray is not, it's not appropriate. It's not the way that a civilized person in such and such a city, such and such a country should pray. And we don't want anyone to get the wrong idea of what Judaism is. We want to present ourselves in a respectable way. So you can hear how the influence from what they were seeing in the surrounding culture was very appealing. And they saw it as an opportunity to say, here we have a chance, and we have to remember, it's what I said a few minutes ago. And again, here tonight I'm not getting political, I'm not getting into who's right, who's wrong. It's just about presenting history and trying to understand what these people were thinking when they we're working through these different issues. I truly believe that everyone was really grappling with what is going to be the future of the Jewish people. I really think they were all asking that question. And if you asked Eliezer Lieberman or any of the 66 rabbis who signed on, who were part of the new Israelite Temple Association at that time, why are you doing this? You're breaking from tradition. Jews have never, you know, have never done these kinds of things in their synagogues, in their communities forever. It's never happened before. Such breaks, such serious types of changes. They would probably look and say, well, if we don't do it, then we're just going to lose all these people anyway. And all these Jews may just leave the community anyway. Perhaps that's one thing that they might have been thinking about. Hard to know, 200 years back. One of the things that he does in his book is he quotes all kinds of different commentaries. For example, when the organ was brought into this Hamburg temple, there was a lot of uproar about such a move, whether it was leaving aside potential halachic issues of music and shul and Shabbat and things of that nature. There was a whole discussion of, this is something that they do in a church. This isn't something that we do in a synagogue. This isn't something that we do in a shul. And he brought all kinds of sources, real legitimate halachic sources to point to that I can show you. Such and such a commentary would say that certain type of musical instrument, as long as the church wasn't doing it for a religious reason, but just to enhance the service, but it doesn't have an idolatrous nature to it. And he's going through this whole process of trying to explain away why these changes should be allowed, why these changes should be permitted. And now, obviously, this wasn't going to go unanswered. This wasn't going to be something that people were just going to allow these changes to just happen and everyone was going to be okay with it. That was not to be the case. The Hamburg Rabbinical Court, the Beit Din, which was made up of Orthodox, weren't called Orthodox yet rabbis, we're using a lot of anachronistic terms here, created a document called Eila Divrei Habrit. These are the words of the covenant. You can imagine what kind of a document this was. It was a response, in essence.
Why would this have come up to them? It wasn't something that they were presented with, or they decided on their own. They had to respond.
It's a great question. It appears that, number one, they saw this as a threat, or a potential threat, to their own community. Number two, this wasn't a small town. This was a center. This was a real large Jewish center. And they saw it as this group, this rabbinical court, we're going to see in a moment. They saw this as a breach in the covenant of the Jewish people. And if you let's look in source number two. There were some big names signed on this letter, some names you may have heard before. Rabbi Akiva Eger was one of them. Chatam Sofer, we're going to look at length in the coming sources. Or Mordechai Bennett, some of the 22 very big names that were signed on in previous weeks. For those who weren't here, we spoke about the Machine Matzah controversy and how each side of the... Whenever you wanted to show that you were strong, you got all the big rabbis of the time to sign a letter saying, we support this, we don't support it, even if they never saw the machines in their life, as we saw at that point. So here they push back. They push back at some of these reforms, they push back at some of these changes, and they write here in their introduction, they have discovered a breach of the law and have sought to contain the prescriptions forbidding the three cardinal sins of reform. And he writes, it's forbidden, number one, to change the worship that is customary in Israel from morning benedictions. One of the things that was in the early liturgies, removal of the Birkot HaShachar, the morning blessings. And all the more so is prohibited to make any deletions in traditional liturgy. It's known in the Talmud as the Matbeya HaTfilah, the coin that the rabbis, the Anshei Knesset Agdola, the original writers of the prayers, they put that into motion and they said this is going to be the liturgy for eternity. It's not something that you can change, you can meddle with. It's forbidden to pray in any language other than the holy tongue. That was number two. Every prayer book that's printed improperly and not in accordance with our traditional practice is invalid, and it's forbidden to pray from it. Which is that, and this is going to come up, you're going to hear this a few times from me in the coming minutes, is that an argument from tradition, or is that an argument from halakha? Is there really an issue with praying in a language that you understand rather than a language that you do not understand? Is that halachically? Is that when I say halachically, what I mean is there a source in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, that says one is not allowed to pray in a language other than Hebrew, other than, we have lots of Siddurim in all of our synagogues that are translated into lots of different languages. Is it problematic to pray from a Siddur that is translated into a language? So part of the question here is, what were they afraid of? Were they afraid of breach in Jewish law, or were they afraid in a breach from tradition? And those are two competing issues that are going to come up in all of the different discussions we're going to see. Number three, it's prohibited to play a musical instrument in the synagogue, on the Sabbath, and on the festivals, even when it is played by a non-Jew. Okay? That's reference to the organ. If you look in the middle column, we hoped in vain, for these men disobeyed the counsel of their teachers and sank into sin. Many of these people probably did not grow up in these break from tradition type of families. Many of the people who were involved in these organizations came from traditional homes themselves. So breaking from that was something that was a big deal. They quickly built for themselves a house of prayer, which they called a temple. By the way, removing the word Jerusalem, Zion, redemption from your prayer book, calling your synagogue a temple. What kind of message does that send the community about where Jerusalem is to them, what Jerusalem means to them, and how that's viewed by the opposition? Publish a prayer book for Sabbaths and festivals, as I mentioned, specifically Sabbaths and festivals, and not incorporating weekday prayers, only incorporating Shabbat, because that was the core time to come to synagogue, and emphasis on just the Shabbat, the one day a week time, caused great sorrow, brought tears to our eyes, so on and so forth. In the bottom, worst of all, they've perpetrated a sore evil by removing references to the belief in the gathering of the exiles, so on and so forth. And then in the third column, on the right side, he goes on and talks about how, you know, the belief that the Mashiach is going to come is such a fundamental idea, it's a fundamental belief of Judaism, kibbutz galiot, that the Jews are going to come from all the corners of the earth to come together in the land of Israel. It's all over our prayers. Can you imagine our prayers, if that's your tradition, can you imagine your prayers, our prayers, without any of those references, our birkat hamazon, our benching, the grace after meals, with any of those deletions? It's hard to even imagine what would be left. What would be left of our prayers without mentions to Tzion and to redemption and to Yerushalayim and to Jerusalem? And of course, as I mentioned, a lot has changed, especially since the establishment of the State of Israel and even before that. And he actually writes here, this group, that this isn't to say that we don't respect governments. This isn't to say that we don't appreciate what the governments have done for us, because they were very appreciative. As we saw in previous weeks, we looked at some of the writings of the Noda B'Yehuda and other rabbinic thinkers who said, we're very thankful for the hospitality, for the opportunities, for the graciousness of our host countries, etc. This wasn't an argument about being granted great things and wonderful, wonderful opportunities. This was about Jews are still Jews, and we still have things that we hope for, and we still have our future that we would like to recreate one day down the line. So let's talk a little bit about the Chatam Sofer. Chatam Sofer was one of the great people who rejected, who was against, who pushed with all of his might against the reforms in Judaism. And he asked the same question. He asks the question, what's the future of the Jewish people? What's left from Judaism if we allow reform to just continue in their path, if I don't say anything, if I don't speak up? So his approach in many ways, which today probably forms what you might call the ultra-Orthodox or Haredi position, was in its original way, in its original form, as we're going to see, I'm going to bring you a number of examples. It's not a compromise, but what you might call a complete rejection of any type of reform. Rav Moshe Sofer, there's a little picture of him here in source number 3. or what they think he looked like. He was born in Frankfurt. He became the rabbi of Preschburg. In 1806, Preschburg was one of the most important Jewish communities at the beginning of the 19th century in Hungary. And he himself was recognized as pretty much the main leader of Central European Jewry at that time. And well known for being against any type of innovation. He coined the pun, which is really a halachic statement, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. Chadash Asur Min HaTorah means anything that is new is against the Torah. But Chadash is a reference to grain, new grain that's grown in the field that's prohibited from being eaten before the Omer sacrifice, which we just commemorated on the second day of Pesach by the counting of the Sfirat HaOmer, this time of the year. So anything that's grown, any type of grain that's grown before is called Chadash. So you're not allowed to eat that grain before the Korban has been brought, before the Omer sacrifice has been brought. He used that term to talk about, I'm going to show you one or two examples, to talk about any type of religious innovation in the Jewish community. And he said, Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, anything that's new is prohibited from the Torah. So he wrote, among many of his writings, and I'm going to show you a few of them, in source number 3, an ethical will. This was very popular among many rabbinic families for the head rabbi or the father of the family to write an ethical will, also known as a tzava'ah. And in these ethical wills, they weren't giving Lamborghinis and houses and millions of dollars over to their children. They were telling their children, these are the practices and customs of our family, and these are the practices and customs that you must keep. So the same way that if the parent is giving over X amount or whatever it is to the child, here it's an ethics will. And the child has to continue those ethics that the parent leaves behind. An interesting concept. So in this tzava'av, the Chatam Sofer, he writes a number of ethics that he wants his children to continue and maintain. But what became of this tzava'ah is it formed the basis really of the ideology of the community that spread out after the Chatam Sofer. So look, you can the Hebrew's on the right side, the English is on the left side. Atem banai uvnotai, my sons, my daughters, chatanai v'nechtai u'bneihem, he's referencing his whole family, his extended family, my sons-in-laws, my grandchildren, their children, listen to me. May your mind not turn to evil. Don't engage in corruptible partnership with those fond of innovations. As a penalty for our many sins, have strayed from the Almighty and His law. Don't live in their neighborhoods. And I actually quoted this a few weeks ago. Don't have any connection to them. And don't read from the books of Rav Moshe Mendelssohn, the Ramad, who we quoted a few weeks ago as being a person who was really traditional, who was really from the camp of the traditionalists. Yet he was taking a stance against him. Then he starts to go into some specifics. You may encounter, you know, hunger and misery, and certain things might be bad for you. He says, don't let in. Don't give in to the temptation. Don't turn to the idols or to some god of your own making. He says, daughters may read German books, an interesting comment here, but only those which may have been written in our own way, according to the interpretations of our teachers. Another way of talking about censorship. And absolutely no others. Be warned not to change your Jewish names, speech, and clothing. If you look in the right side, he used this phrase, Ziharu Mishino Hashem, it's in the middle one. Be cautious of changing your name, your language, and your clothing. V'siman, and he gave an acronym for this. Shalem. What does Shalem mean? Shemot. The Shin is Shemot, names. The Lamed is Levush, clothing. And the Mem, Lashon is the Lamed, and the Mem is Malbush, which is another way of saying if you want to be a whole Jew, if you want to be a full Jew, you have to keep these three items. And he was referencing here not necessarily the Jewish people in Egypt, that Midrash that some here might be familiar with, that when the Jews were in Egypt, they maintained some of their identity, and the identity is defined as name, clothing, and language. Here, he's talking about Vayavo Yaakov Shalem. Where was Jacob coming from? He was coming from 22 years in his father-in-law's house. And his father-in-law was not the most ethical being. Yet, Yaakov emerged from that experience, Shalem. So he's invoking this biblical story to talk about how the Jew of his day should continue to maintain and upkeep the strength of the identity through these items. And he goes on. He talks about prayer, and he talks about all these different things that were going on in his time. And what's fascinating about this is this didn't just become a family document. This became a community document. This became something that put into motion a community that we know today very well, which is part of the Jewish world. Here are some examples from the Chatam Sofer's writing of the types of issues that he came out very strongly against. Here's one issue. Jewish names and non-Jewish names. Is there a halachic issue with having a non-Jewish name? Maybe, maybe not. It's a debate in Jewish law. But most people that we know in our society, in North American society, in the last 200 years of history, have taken on Jewish name and a non-Jewish name. The Chatam Sofer felt that giving yourself a non-Jewish name, giving your child a non-Jewish name, was a terrible thing. And he writes here, not necessarily in reference to a Jew giving himself a non-Jewish name, but he's writing as a commentary on the Torah about a certain Jew who became a very controversial person named Korach. Korach led a rebellion against Moshe. Korach's rebellion ended in a very tragic way for him and his family and his followers. They were all killed, swallowed up by the earth. They were challenging the leadership. They were challenging God's appointment of Moshe and Aaron as the leaders, as the Kohen, Kohen Gadol. And he points out here in his commentary that Korach was not a new name. Korach was actually a name of one of Esav's offspring. An officer, if you look back at in Bereishit, when it lists all the offspring of the descendants of Yitzchak, Esav, and Yaakov, and you have there the list, one of the names is Korach. And he goes on and he talks about a person's name impacts their character. So if you give your child a name of a non-Jewish, whatever part of society you're taking that name from, that name is going to be an influence on the personality of the person.
So when did the family names come into play?
So we spoke about that in one of the previous sessions. It came out differently in different countries at different points in history. In Europe, it was coming out just after emancipation. So late 18th century, Jews, non-Jews, everyone was taking on last names, and it had to do with accountings. People had to keep track of people's names, so they needed last names to be written down. One of the main students of the Chatam Sofer, who we're also going to look at a few of his comments, the Maharam Shik, Rav Moshe Shik, who basically studied the Chatam Sofer's teachings. He was a student by him for 6 years. He came out very strongly, many ways even stronger than his Rebbe, than his Rabbi, the Chatam Sofer came out. And he talks about non-Jewish names as well. He says in source number 6 here, he says, Ra'iti, there's people taking on these non-Jewish names, V'shem HaGoyim, in the second line there, and people were thinking this is okay. And he writes, what about the Jews in Egypt? Remember the Jews in Egypt? They didn't change their identity, they didn't change their names, they kept their Jewish names. And he says, oh, you know what they'll say? They'll say, as long as I have a Jewish name that I can be called up to the Torah with. Right? He says, that's okay. Then I can have my non-Jewish name for the street, and I can have my Jewish name for the shul. That should be okay. Says the Maharam Shik, no, fire and brimstone. He comes out, he says, it's a Isser Doraita. It's against the Torah to have a non-Jewish name. He quotes the Rambam, Hilchot Avodah Zarah. It's a pasuk in Parsha Kedoshi. We were separated from all the nations to be a nation to God. And he brings from the Midrash, we're not allowed to do anything to be like them, to look like them, to act like them, them being the non-Jewish nations. And he goes on. If you turn the page, we'll look at one or two more examples. The use of the secular calendar was something that the Chatam Sofer also felt was an infringement on tradition, something that Jews hadn't been doing, hadn't been using. And he writes here about a little bit about the history of the Jewish months. As we know, we just read the Torah readings on over Pesach. The early way that we would call the Jewish months was not by their Hebrew names that we have today. They're actually not Hebrew, they're Persian names. But Iyar, Nisan, we're in the month of Nisan, it's the month of Pesach. And those, that's not how the months were called. The months were called Chodesh HaRishon, Chodesh HaSheni, the first month, the second month. Why were they called that? We counted the months based on when we had left Egypt. So all of the months were counted based on how far away they were from our time in Egypt. So we're 1 month away from when we were in Egypt, we're 2 months away from when we were in Egypt, we're 3 months away from when we were in Egypt, and we count according to the moon. And then it changed. At what point did it change?
With the kings.
So he writes, quotes the Ramban, you're close. It's around, it was a long period of kings. So which kings? He quotes in the fifth line there, Katav Ramban, Shenevim Achronim, the later prophets, changed the names to use the names we use today, Nisan, Iyar, Sivan. These are Persian names. Why did those names change from the first month, second month? The Ramban explains in Shmot, when God gives us the command for the months, the Ramban explains that the change came about because we had a new redemption to celebrate. What was the new redemption to celebrate? Coming back to the land of Israel to rebuild the second temple after 70 years of the Babylonian exile. So to celebrate our most recent redemption, we're going to call the months by these new names, Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, etc. So what ended up happening, says the Chatam Sofer, we ended up counting the months by the second redemption that we know about, which was the redemption coming back, Cyrus giving the Jews the permission to go back, build the second temple, and the weekdays are based on the earlier system. What is Sunday in Hebrew? Yom Rishon. Monday, Yom Sheni. How do we count those days? Based on Shabbos, which is the day of creation. So we celebrate creation, we celebrate redemption, and that's how Jews should count. That's how Jews should count their week, and that's how Jews should count their months. Unless the person think they should count their months based on the birth of the Christian Savior, he writes this here in the left column. He says, "V'lo kachadashim mikarov shimonim," not like this new way of counting, that they're counting according to the birth of the Christian. Hello, Yeboshu Be Yisrael al Tmurazu, and then in the footnote, this seems to be have been added in later. It's very small print. I'll just tell you what he says. He says at the end, he says, anyone who counts by the non-Jewish months, Chotem Atzmo She'ein Lo Chelak Belokei Yisrael Oy Lahem Ki Gamalu Lanafsham Ra'ah, which basically means you're not a believer in God, and woe unto you if you count by April the 19th, 2017.
But you said these were Persian names, weren't they Hebrew names?
Right, right. So the Persian names was to remember that we went through an experience where we were saved, and now we're remembering the Persian redemption, in a sense.
But you could do that by giving
Hebrew
names.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question. So this question came up again. The Maharam Sheikh, his student, I'm not going to read through the tshuva because I want to get to Rav Hirsch in a moment. But the Maharam Sheikh in source number 8, he discusses a question that came up where a gravestone had been set up in a certain cemetery.
The rest of this recording will be a continuation of the previous recording, but was lost during the Shi'ur. So the Maharam Sheikh, student of the Chatam Sofer, he talks about a case where a gravestone was set up in a cemetery, and on the gravestone, the English date, secular date, that belonged to the day of death of the individual who was buried there, was placed on the gravestone. And the question that was asked was if this is inappropriate for an English date to be on a gravestone, to be in a graveyard, in the presence of other deceased bodies who have to bear the shame of being near a body that has an English date on it. And the Maram Shik spends a lot of time talking about how big of an embarrassment it is that this could even happen. Essentially, he feels that something should be done about it. And you understand the challenge that is being explained here, is being understood here. Two final pieces here from the Chatam Sofer. Number one, in source number 9, Chatam Sofer has a discussion about the location of a bima. Bima is the table that's found in a shul upon which the Torah is read. And in the discussion, there was at that time a movement in the Reform Temple to move the location of the bima from the middle of the shul to the front of the shul. If one looks at the Rambam, when he speaks about the laws of a Beit Knesset, the Rambam understands that a bima should be placed in the middle for optimal acoustic experience, so that everyone in the room can hear the Kriyat HaTorah. Chatam Sofer understood that anyone who would think that they can move the bima to another location in the shul is not doing it for the purposes of anything but trying to copy a different religion or a different practice, and he felt that that was something that was unforgivable, to the extent that a student who we've seen a few times already, the Maram Shik, he said you can't even go into a shul that has a bima that was moved to a different location. Chatam Sofer backs up his opinion. He says if you looked in the Beit HaMikdash, there was two altars, two mizbachot that you could find. Both were in central middle locations in the areas that they were found. The mizbeach that was on the outside, that was for the animal sacrifice, that was used as a central location during the holiday of Sukkot. People would walk around hakafot with their lulavs, and the mizbeach ketoret, the incense altar that was on the inside of the Beit HaMikdash, also centrally located in that room. Chatam Sofer quotes a Gemara, talks about the shul in Alexandria, Egypt, where the bima was in the middle, and there were so many people, they would have to wave flags to let people know that the chazan was reciting a bracha to say amen. What you see is the Chatam Sofer is trying to ground this tradition of having the bima in the middle of the room in either in historical reality or in some kind of halachic basis. At the end of the day, his motto here and in other places is Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. He felt that any type of change that veered away from a traditional practice was problematic. To segue into Rav Hirsch, we have a tshuva, another tshuva from the Chatam Sofer in source number 10, where he, so much a tshuva, more of a warning. And in here, he goes very strongly about the importance of separating, being separate from those within the community who are creating divisions and creating new ideas of what Judaism is supposed to be. And he put this into writing. Rav Hirsch was supportive of this. Rav Hirsch had a different approach, different response to the changes that were being developed and introduced by the Reform Temple. But nevertheless, he was in agreement with Chatam Sofer that some of these changes were so egregious, were so crossing all the lines, that it was necessary to be separate when it comes to marriage, when it comes to relationships with these other members. Think about the type of divisions that would create in the community at that time as well. Rav Hirsch was born in 1808 He was born in Hamburg, which we already mentioned was the location of the first Reformed temple. His family was traditional and against Reform. He was university educated, and in 1830 he became a rabbi in a shul in a community called Oldenburg, which was in Germany. And at that time he wrote a few of his very famous, later famous books, 19 Letters and Chorev, in which he really lays out his philosophical approach to Judaism, to the Judaism of the time, to the future of the Jewish people. And his main point is that you can be a traditional Jew in this world. In some ways, Rav Hirsch agreed that some external or aesthetic points need to be changed, need to be altered, same way that the Reform felt there were aesthetic elements that needed to be changed. But where he veered and where he was different is that he did not feel that there should be any change to the principles. So on the one hand, Rav Hirsch supported secular education, but on the other hand, he made sure that the Jewish education was just as strong and just as central, if not even more central, which he felt it has to be the basis. And his philosophy is based in many ways on a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, which is here in source number 11. The Mishnah says, Yafe Talmud Torah im derech eretz. Talmud Torah will be successful. One's Torah learning is beautiful, is yafe, when it is coupled with, when it is joined together with derech eretz, loosely translated and understood by most of the commentaries as work, as having a profession. In one of his early essays, in which he attacks Reform with some very harsh language, an article called Religion Allied with Progress, Rav Hirsch lays out this philosophy. He writes here in source number 12, in the left column, Religion Allied to Progress. The leaders of Reform have with undaunted courage embroidered the slogan in scintillating colors on the banner of a present-day religious struggles, that the educated, progressive sons and daughters of the New Age might rally to this new flag of the Prophet and advance with it unhindered. Since the beginning of the century, the ancient religion had been to them ancient. It no longer fit into the society of the sons and daughters of the New Age with their frock coats and evening dresses. Everywhere, the old Judaism was in the way and seemed so completely out of place. And even in the counting house and in the office and in the courtroom and at the easel and board ship and in the train, throughout the stream-driven lightning activity of the New Age, the old Judaism acted as a brake on the hurrying march of progress. You hear in his words a harsh criticism of how Reform was basically throwing away what they deemed to be Judaism because it was old, the principles that they no longer wanted to stand by. And if you look in the middle paragraph, this statement, Religion Allied to Progress, which was the banner that he titles the banner of their movement. By this one magic phrase, he distilled the ancient world-ranging spirit of the Torah into a single aromatic drop of perfume, so fragrant that in the most elegant party dress, they could carry it round with them in their waistcoat pockets without being ashamed. By means of it, with this line, he carved out of the ponderous old rock-hewn tablets of the law ornamental figures so tiny that people gladly found room for them on smart dressing tables in drawing rooms and ballrooms. By means of this one magic phrase, he so skillfully loosened, listen to the words, the rigid bonds of the old law with its 613 locks and chains. Strong, harsh words. And he points out that this whole giving of names to different movements and strands within the opposition, something that was granted by the Reform themselves. Calling Orthodox Jews Orthodox actually came from that position, which was starting to change things. They needed to coin everybody else's stance So they coined Rav Hirsch's or others in that camp the stance of the Orthodox position. And then at the end, in the right column, you can see how Rav Hirsch develops his idea about Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz. So one of the examples of Torah im Derech Eretz philosophy is education. In one of Rav Hirsch's many writings on education, he says in source 13, "It would be most perverse and criminal of us to seek to instill in our children a contempt, based on ignorance and untruth, for everything that is not specifically Jewish, for all other human arts and sciences, and the belief that by inculcating our children with such a negative attitude, we could safeguard them from contacts with the scholarly and scientific endeavors of the rest of mankind." In other words, what Rav Hirsch is saying here is that we have to be very careful about how we talk about the outside culture, the outside science that's not based in Torah, how we talk about it to our children, how we educate our children toward it, and in its most basic form, how we expose, what we expose, when we expose them to it as well. You will then see that your simple-minded calculations were just as criminal as they were perverse. His point is that if we hide the outside culture from our children, we're going to end up doing more harm than good. Criminal because they enlist the help of untruth, supposedly in order to protect the truth, and because you have thus departed from the path upon which your own sages have preceded you and beckoned you to follow. He believes that this is part of Chazal's program. Perverse because by doing so you have achieved precisely opposite of what you wanted to accomplish. Your child will consequently begin to doubt all of Judaism, which can exist only in the night and darkness of ignorance, and which must close its eyes and minds of its adherents to the light of all knowledge if it is not to perish. It's another way of saying that Rav Hirsch really believed we have an obligation to teach our children the path that is based in Torah, is rooted in Torah, and will ultimately be able to expose our children to these other elements that can benefit our Judaism, our understanding of this world, but through the lens of Torah. If they're going to get exposed to it anyway, but never have been given a paradigm or a set of instructions or a perspective to allow them to understand the world through the lens of Torah, then they're going to have a more corrupt vision because of this. There's a debate whether Rav Hirsch's philosophy or approach of Torah im Derech Eretz was considered a compromise, what you might call a horat sha'ah because of the time, because of the challenge of the time, or there was something that he really felt was an ideal. Shimon Schwab in source 14, who eventually was the Rav of one of the main continuing communities of Rav Hirsch's original community in Hamburg, where he was the rabbi there for 37 years, he believed that this was an ideal. He believed that Rav Hirsch's perspective was an ideal, and it was something that would be able to stand for the rest of history. A few excerpts from Rav Hirsch's commentary in source 15 to highlight how his philosophy made it into many of his different writings. You have here different excerpts from his Perush on the Torah. For example, on the left side, you have Dvarim Perek Dalid. It's this description in the Psukim about asking and talking about historical events, and what he points out here is that not only is studying history something that's permitted, but it's something which is desirable to the fullest possible extent. The mind armed with such a wide panoramic view on all matters can draw the right conclusions of the Jewish position in the world in the whole of its specialty. In other words, studying science, studying history, he mentions that again in the next line in Shema Yisrael, a similar type of comment. Studying all of these things will actually allow us to understand Jewish history better, understand our Torah better, to our advantage to get involved with the studies that are outside of our own Torah. But be careful to do it with the Yirat Shemaim and the right prioritizing of where the Torah fits in the plan, as he says in his comment in Bereishit as well. When he talks about V'dibar Tabam, of course, Torah has to be the Ikar. We say that in Shema every day. Yet, Rav Hirsch points out that this is not excluding studying other things. It's understanding where Torah is, as mentioned. Finally, the approach of the conservative movement, which was developed in part by one of its founding fathers, Zacharias Frankel. He was a Bohemian German rabbi and a historian who studied historical development of Judaism. He was born in Prague. And this historical Judaism eventually became conservative Judaism. And what he does in his article in 17, without not having the time to go into all of it, he talks about the Orthodox position. Then he talks about the Reform position. And then he talks about a third party. So some kind of middle ground. And here's what he says. We will now turn to a third party which has arisen from the first party and not only stands within the bound of Judaism, but is also filled with real zeal for its preservation and endeavors to hand it over to the descendants and make it the common good of all times. This party bases itself upon rational faith and recognizes that the task of Judaism is religious action. But it demands that this action shall not be empty of spirit and that shall not become merely mechanical. So the original thinking was that we're trying to battle against Reform, who were taking away a lot of the action-related parts of the religion, and at the same time being cognizant that times have changed. And that and he mentions that in his writings as well. It has also reached a view that religious activity itself must be brought up to a higher level through giving way to many meanings with which it should be endowed. Holds that we must omit certain unimportant actions which are not inherently connected either with the higher ideas or with religious forms delineated by the revealed laws, and so on and so forth. The idea here, which I want to emphasize, is that each of these streams, whether you look at the Chasam Sofer, you look at Rav Hirsch, or you look at Frankel, number one, we could probably agree that the streams that we made today hang their hats on 200 years ago, be it ultra-Orthodoxy, Haredi, whatever title you want to give to that community, modern Orthodox, neo-Orthodox, whatever title you want to give to that community, the conservative movement within Judaism, and even the Reform movement, do not all look the same way that they were created to be 200 years ago. That's point number one. Point number two is what we've done is we've looked at how each of these communities within the European change that was taking place were responding to a real question of what's the future of the Jewish people. And in so many ways, it's interesting to put ourselves into the shoes of these leaders, of these communities, and try to ask ourselves, what will we do? What will we have done? Had we been there, what would our reactions have been to some of the changes of the time? Would we have sided with one more than the other? Would we have found a new path that wasn't suggested by any? It's important to look back at these moments because they reflect on certain questions that we're still facing today. And those are the questions of, what is the future of the Jewish people? What does the future of the Jewish people look like? And for us, we have a role to play in that as well.